Welcome to Making Sense of the MarTech, an irregular set of conversations with some of the most interesting people in marketing, technology, and advertising. I'm Juan Mendoza. I write the MarTech Weekly newsletter. It's a weekly email that covers important shifts in the marketing, tech, and media world. You can read, listen, and subscribe at themartechweekly.com. Before we go into our episode today, I would love to share with you something new from the MarTech Weekly. It's called TMW 100. We've launched a new MarTech Innovation Awards program ranking MarTech companies from first place to 100th place globally. We're announcing the winners in the first week of November in Anaheim, California, live with Mopsapalooza from MarketingOps.com. Our judges include folks like Scott Brinker, Daryl Alfonso, and Jessica Cow. If you're building innovative marketing technology, I invite you to prove it at themartechweekly.com/TMW100. That's themartechweekly.com/TMW100. All right, back to our show. Okay, today I am joined by Jay Sanderson. He's the Senior Manager of Product Marketing for Progress Digital Experiences. Now, Progress enables customers to develop applications and experiences they need, deploy when, where, they, how, and how they manage it all safely and securely. Hundreds of thousands of enterprises, including 1,700 software companies and 3.5 million developers, use Progress every day to deploy customer experiences on their development platform. Now, Jay has worked across a number of companies such as Sitecore, AT&T, and Thomson Reuters. After moving from a more development and technical role with a variety of these companies, he kind of moved into the world of digital marketing. He quickly realized the need for data-driven decision-making and new ways to leverage MarTech platforms to drive growth and revenue. He's taken the red pill like the rest of us here in the MarTech space. He's become an advocate for using digital experience platforms to really drive that growth and opportunity. Now, in this episode, we kind of talk about the changing category of digital experience platforms. You'll probably hear us talk a little bit about DXPs. That's the acronym, digital experience platforms. Now, we'll talk about how Jay sort of approaches composability in CDP and DXP space, generative AI, and the new interfaces for building customer experiences, and what the leading edge of personalization looks like for the enterprise. And so I'm really excited to have Jay on to give us a bit of an insight into what is that leading edge of digital experiences. So now I'm going to hand it over to Jay Sanderson. Jay, how you doing?
I'm good, Juan. Thank you very much for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you, and I've been dying to talk about both of these topics, composability in the CDP DXP space, but also in the generative AI and how software companies are actually starting to think of integrating these tools into their platforms. But maybe we can start off with an introduction to your journey. I mean, how did you kind of find your way into the realm of MarTech and DXPs? Perhaps you can define what a digital experience platform is as a starting point and how you kind of got into that world.
I guess a bit of an old timer. So we've been kind of involved with the internet since early days, since kind of pre-web and stuff like that. So that was kind of during high school. I was a bit of an IT nerd, and then kind of getting out of that. I thought I wanted to be a developer, a programmer sort of thing. So I was kind of around in the late 90s at the start of my career, kind of in that sort of first initial dot-com boom, sort of saw that come and go. And then on the back of that, tumbled into commerce development, web development, all that kind of thing, started doing a bit of freelancing on the side, building websites for people and whatnot. And that was my sort of foray into kind of the ad tech, kind of getting into Google AdWords and things of that nature back when you could buy clicks for cents each. It was a cheap way to kind of bring a kind of a quick ROI, but quickly kind of learned, I guess, a lot of those kind of conversion rate optimization basics and all of that kind of thing. But I continued on with my development career for kind of close to around sort of 15 years, and then had the opportunity to move into more of a digital marketing focused role, starting as an analyst and then sort of moving up to digital marketing, running digital marketing teams for B2C telco specifically. And after having a few successes with the DXP, that's almost sort of first role in the software vendor space. So that took me to Sitecore, and then from Sitecore onto Progress.
Really, Ralph? So what kind of opportunities did you find in that world of DXPs? Can you take us through some of the early sort of forays using the tech? Sounds like you were more on the sort of the client or the brand side trying to stand up and use this technology. What was that kind of like in the early days of DXP?
Yeah, so my route to DXP was probably like a little bit more, a little bit different to most, like, because I started off in the commerce space, so it wasn't really in and out of CMSs all the time, but commerce is where I kind of played most of the time. But when you take as kind of a standalone commerce solution and you want to, you know, deliver a personalized experience, or you want to optimize, or you want to A/B test and whatnot, all of a sudden this standalone commerce platform that you might have needs a bunch of other different features. And so that's when I initially kind of set out on my quest. Not only did we want that optimization and personalization capability, but we did also want a more stronger content management capability within our commerce platform. So that's what sort of shot us out to market, and that's what sort of saw me enter the space. That was 8 years ago. So I've kind of, you know, been through this sort of the rise and now the reshaping of the DXP market.
So I guess this world of digital experience platforms, I mean, to some, it's kind of very closely overlapping with the content management system, the CMS world. You know, it kind of fits in a few different things. It's sort of orchestrating data, making use of that data. It's also the experience and just like content, websites, platforms, apps, you know, various sort of experience and touch points of consumers. It kind of sits in this interesting sort of world between the actual content output from a brand, but then also the data to orchestrate that to make that personalized and relevant for a consumer as well. But what I'm kind of seeing within that sort of DXP space is that the customer data platform world is increasingly getting into that. I'm seeing more customer data platforms build sort of bespoke experience activation features, whether that be sort of A/B testing within sort of a holistic sort of experience, or building out sort of app notifications, or even working in the email space as well. Customer data platforms are seeing sort of the opportunity, given that they've got, you know, a lot of these platforms have a lot of that sort of very refined, very enriched sort of customer data. But how are you sort of seeing these two, product categories, you could call them, within the enterprise working together, the DXP and the CDP? How are they sort of working together, and should they be one category? Over to you, Jay. What do you think?
Yeah, probably not. I guess, yeah, if we start with DXP first, I don't think you'd be kind of pretty hard pressed to find anything that's classified as a DXP that didn't start life as a CMS, and more than likely not just a CMS, but a WCMS, meaning, you know, it's only for the web and whatnot. And then if you look at early adopters of those platforms, you know, that were in that DXP category, a lot of the time they're building websites and whatnot. Maybe they're websites with enhanced experience, being able to kind of personalize the journey for the user on the fly, all of that kind of thing. Maybe they had personalization capability built into it. Maybe they had marketing automation built into it. Maybe they had commerce. But there wasn't a kind of an exact mold as to what a DXP is. But I think when you think about the personalization aspect of a DXP, it needs to know about the customer, at least to some extent, whether it's within session, whether it's spread across multiple interactions that it's had with the brand. It had that sense of knowing about the customer. So I think that's where kind of CDP starts to be being pulled into it, right? And just while we're on that kind of notion of that kind of digital experience platform, I think really, like, in my mind, digital experience platform is what the marketer creates at that end user client site, if you like. You might have a CMS, you might have an automation platform, you might have an email marketing platform, you might have analytics, you might have a commerce platform, whatever that, what are we up to now? 20,000 different bits of software in the MarTech category space, I'm sure you'll know, but whichever, you know, of those that you grab from your color palette to build a system that's right for you, you know, in my mind, that is your DXP. And sure, content features very, very heavily there. But you know, it's part of a much, much broader team. And then when it comes to CDP, I guess we've been probably sort of seeing a lot of ambiguity introduced into that kind of market as well. Everyone's sort of, you know, kind of quickly kind of rushing to kind of start collecting their own customer data, because obviously of all the things that are happening kind of above the line, or however you kind of want to frame it, off-site, if you like, you're gonna lose that ability to kind of just quickly go and reach customers at a particular point in time. It's not going to be as easy as what it used to be. So preparing for that, I guess that's where the CDP comes into it. But a lot of people are kind of, one, yeah, is still struggling to find what do I actually need as an organization as far as the CDP goes. And secondly, no, especially when it comes to personalization, where do I start? Big organizations, small organizations, a lot of people are sort of finding themselves sort of thinking, well, you know, where do I start? Like, I see all of these great stories of people delivering these experiences, but what about us? And I think a lot of the time, personalization and optimization, when you're talking about it from a commerce perspective, if you're selling T-shirts, if you're selling something online, you've got a very kind of clear path to conversion. It can be, I don't want to say easier, but you know, the path of what you want to achieve and how to measure, you know, they can come quite quickly too. Whereas if you go and take organizations whose role is to just provide excellent customer experience, to disseminate information, government institutions, manufacturers, where they're not sort of on the front line as far as the customer experience goes, they have a more sort of taxing time, but there's still oodles of opportunity out there for them to make use of that kind of personalization and CDP technology.
You raise an interesting point that I guess the CDP, traditionally, like when the category sort of started emerging about 7 years ago, it was actually a lot about, like a lot of the use cases was about sort of own channel personalization, whether it be email personalization, web, A/B testing, experimentation, or in app. I mean, like if you go into any sort of CDP pitch, they're talking about using your first-party data, bringing that together all into one system, creating these customer profiles, and then activating them with personalized experiences. They're relevant to consumers because you're able to know far more from various touch points than you would previously. Now, that value proposition still remains, but now with the, as you say, cookies, third-party cookies going away, ad tech platforms increasingly seeing ad tech systems even coming into the CDP space, and that's becoming the scope and the remit of CDP is actually much broader now. But like the core of it and a lot of the value proposition, like at a very basic level, is just being able to say, to run a really good personalized experience, or to be able to recommend similar articles to what a consumer's reading at that point in time, or a product that a customer might like because they've previously purchased X, Y, or Z. Or even things like just like rewarding really high value, high lifetime value customers as well. You know, all of those sort of basic use cases are sort of where you would sort of start, I guess, with a CDP. But when it comes to a DXP, I guess, how do you think about it? So, of course, you just mentioned it's the CMS is sort of the starting point, but how does DXP work across a variety of channels? Or do you think about DXP more from the perspective of just web?
Definitely not just web when it comes to DXP or CDP for that matter. I think there's definitely scope to use it completely removed from web if that's your choice. I think digital's almost getting a bit long in the tooth, right? Like digital, it's just digital, right? It's like okay, let's just call it experience. So you know, like we can deliver personalized experiences via DXP offline, right? In the non-digital world, that's all possible. I guess to jump to an analogy, because I know that we're kind of talking about composability and DXP and all of that kind of thing. I was just thinking about it in terms of hi-fi. You know, if we sort of think back to when everyone didn't used to have Bluetooth speakers for everything, and you know, back in the sort of the 90s and the 80s and beyond, a bit before that, everyone had these kind of component hi-fi systems. You know, you had your turntable, or CD player, if you're like in the 90s, all of these different kind of components, and that to me is kind of like this composable system. But then you've got to look at like, well, what is it that I want to do? Do I want to listen to records? Do I want to listen to CDs? Do I want to listen to the radio, kind of thing? So that's individual components. But then when you think about, is it okay, breaking that mold, you go back to some of these marketing suites and whatnot, where they've got a CMS, but maybe they want to add some A/B testing, kind of thing. Now, depending on the user, that might be totally fine. And when it kind of bring back to that hi-fi analogy, I've got a hi-fi system, I listen to records. I've got an amplifier, it's got a built-in phono stage to take my turntable, kind of thing. It's got a built-in Bluetooth receiver. Now, it wasn't the cheapest, it certainly wasn't the most expensive. But if I want to get really, really serious about playing records, like hi-fi people will know that the amplifier and the turntable could be replaced with another few devices, between it, the record and the speaker, kind of thing. It's just about how far do I kind of want to get into this? What performance do I need out of it? What are my boxes that I need to tick, right? So I think that when we kind of look at what's happened with DXP over the last kind of 8 years, I think first of all, we saw all of these CMS people come into play. Personalization was a really, really hot topic. We saw CMS kind of get deprecated as a mainstream term for a lot of the major players. They added personalization, they added marketing automation, they added testing and whatnot to their stacks. But I think what they kind of quickly came to realize is that it's really hard to develop out each one of those core features inside a single stack and continually meet the needs of your customers when they're constantly kind of going out to market and they're going and looking at something that only does testing or something that only does personalization. And then they're coming back to you and they're saying, well, hang on, why doesn't your platform do that when I can go and buy this standalone piece of software that only does testing and might even be the fact that it's a lot cheaper, kind of thing. And I think a lot of the times it comes back to not so much around, well, it's enterprise software and we need to be solid and our stuff works. I think a lot of the time it just comes down to the big kind of DXP with Cycle or Optimizer or Progress or whatnot. You still got a limited number of developers pushing out features to a lot of customers. Everything kind of has to be kind of prioritized. So I think, what does composability give us? Composability gives us the ability to customize a digital experience platform. And when I say DXP platform here, I'm talking about like a whole collection of apps, whatever makes up your world and your organization. And you can do that by picking and choosing the things that are going to make sense to you. Like if you're not doing A/B testing, like a lot of companies have failed to make A/B testing work. Now, outside the commerce realm, it's not bread and butter for a lot of people. Personalization might be a much better kind of fit for organizations when it comes to optimizing the experience. That being said, though, if you do require testing, it might be that a basic testing feature set that might live within a DXP might be good enough for your business requirements. So this kind of goes back to that stereo analogy. It's like, well, do I really need to have a separate phono stage to play my records? Like, heck, I'm half deaf anyway. I'll appreciate it. Anything's going to sound better than the Bluetooth speakers that we've all been listening to for so long.
Yeah.
So I really think that, and apologies for that, I'm kind of going off track here, but when it comes to people talk about the monolith being a bad thing. Monoliths aren't necessarily bad if the features that sit within there are fit for your business and they do what you need to do. It's only when they don't, and I think that what we sort of saw in the sort of 2015-16 kind of that sort of mid 2010 kind of era, we probably saw a lot of people, a lot of vendors try and cram too much functionality into the one app, and it really just didn't scale in line with the brands that they were working with.
Mm.
Could you unpack what Monolith is for our audience? You know, what I've got in my mind is like, you know, your big Salesforce marketing clouds or your Adobe digital experience clouds. Is that kind of what you mean by Monolith, or like, how do you sort of define that?
Yeah, good question. Yes, keeping that stereo analogy running.
Now, keep it rolling.
We can think about these. We can think about these all-in-one systems. Do you know what I mean? It's like the one that's it's made to look like separate components, but it's actually just one big block of electronics, and it's one big box. And if the amp dies, then the whole lot dies. But
yeah,
and that's not what it is with DXP. But it means that if you want to use a different tuner module, if you wanted to use a different tape player or whatever it is, if you wanted to modify the system, it's either going to be impossible or it's going to be very expensive, just not really kind of worth your time. So when I'm thinking about monoliths, I'm thinking about a marketing suite that's probably going to have and I guess this could be monolithic as it pertains to commerce or CMS. I don't think there's I think we can use the term monolith everywhere, but it's going to have several functions within it kind of baked in. I think another trait of the monoliths is requiring a significant amount of knowledge to be productive within it from a developer standpoint. Now, one of the kind of the things that I constantly hear about people sort of kind of battling their own monolith is, it takes me so long to do anything. Every time I've got to come and go and create a page or something like that, I've got to go and get a developer. This isn't what they told me when I was buying it. Why is it kind of taking too long? Or that there's continual upgrades you've got to get into play and whatnot. So again, I think I'm using this word ambiguity a lot. Ambiguity, I should say. I guess monoliths no stranger to that either. But I think from my point of view, monoliths is one system doing many things, and let's kind of look at the weight of it. Like, it could be a big system, and it's going to be a big system either because it does a lot of things or because it's just literally kind of slow and pulling along. It's to keep pushing along, takes a lot of time, effort, resources.
Indeed, it does. And I think that your framing there of the monolith is quite interesting, and I think it's quite helpful in that it's, it once started off as a platform, like it was like one thing. And then as the market evolves and changes, they kind of keep adding things, or they make a lot of M&A to sort of to offer more solutions to keep customers in their ecosystem. I'm thinking of three acquisitions over the past 2 or 3 years that kind of represent this quite a bit. The first one was EpiServer acquiring Optimizely. I'm not sure if you remember this, about 2 years ago, sort of traditional CMS platform. And then they acquired Optimizely, ended up taking the Optimizely name, which is interesting in itself. But they acquired Optimizely for its data management capabilities, but more importantly, its personalization and A/B testing capabilities. And so now you can buy the Optimizely stack, which also has a CMS. That kind of feels really aligned, but again, it's that kind of bringing together a variety of technologies instead of using a bunch of different point solutions. The other one, which is actually from your background, is Sitecore. Acquired a CDP company, and now they're calling it Sitecore CDP and Personalize, I think. And, e-commerce, CMS platform, that's a bread and butter, but increasingly they're wanting to bring those data management capabilities and personalization capabilities. And I think their CDP now offers A/B testing as well. So you can kind of see that, but what I'm kind of hearing is that the DXP, I think you mentioned this before we got into this conversation, which was that the P in DXP is probably not platform, right? It's more partner. But I'm kind of thinking more as DXP, it's more of about the stack you have. It's the right technologies that are in your business, the right mix of talent, and the right, say, agency, consultancy partners and tech partners that could actually help you use these different technologies instead of sort of going with the monolith, one shop for everything. Is that, am I hearing you right? Like, is that sort of a way of thinking about DXP? It's probably a variety of technologies in a stack or a variety of partners.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's certainly one that I like to lean on. I think that when you, like you as I do, you get to see, you get to go and talk to a lot of people that have got a different smattering of technology. Now, probably very rarely is one organization exactly the same. There's so many different choices you've got at every category. So I think where that kind of that partner thing kind of comes back to, I think even if you go and look across all of the DXP vendors or the people that are kind of putting out something that they kind of want to talk to as a DXP, or they want to be known by the analysts as a DXP vendor, even when you look at their own specific offerings, it's dissimilar. No, some people have got commerce, some people don't. Some people have got marketing relations, some people don't. And then even if you want to jump into one of the specific features of their platform, again, you'll see differences there. Everything's not as it seems. So I think that where I think the partner kind of comes into it, and this could be used in from the consulting partner to the actual vendor partner, it's really got to come back to, what do you as an experienced provider or as a client, end user, whatever you want to refer to yourself as, what is it that you want to achieve? What's the needle that you want to move? Where do you see your customers? How do they interact with your brands? How can you track them? How can you profile them? What's the best way to deliver that experience? Is it email? Is it, is it a text message? Is it rewarding loyal customers? Just tracking, what's happening, being able to kind of, follow the journey end to end and insert, correct experience where you can.
Yeah, I think you're right that the thread within this conversation so far is kind of coming to this from a first principles perspective, right? There's all these crazy words like composability and CDP and DXP and all these different things to think about, which is some very basic stuff, Jay. What's the kinds of experiences that you want for your customer across the channels that you've selected? What are those things that you want to deliver? And what are the best technologies to help you get there, right? And what I see, particularly in the CMS world, is that a lot of people working in that space from the, say, campaign marketer just trying to push out deals and offers and emails and promotions on their website through to the people that are doing the data orchestration and all the data management work, is that they kind of butt heads with CMSs often because it's like, oh, we want to do this, but we can't do it, right? Our CMS doesn't allow it, or it's another $50,000 upgrade to be able to do that within our CMS, right? And I think that, of all the sort of categories in MarTech, I think the CMS space perhaps is not as malleable as, say, the customer data platform space or in other sort of categories of tech, where it's like, we want to build something. All right, we just need the right data, the right integration, the right platform, and off we go. CMS is so ingrained and embedded within the workflows of marketers that it's actually really hard to shift out of that. And I think what I appreciate is that you talking about composability from the stereo, the hi-fi stereo analogy, which is quite interesting, is that you're thinking about it, it's like, well, how far do you want to push this, right? How do you want to set up a hi-fi system? Are you an audiophile, right? Where you're actually thinking about, how do I get the best sort of amplification of this audio, the best possible speakers, right? Some brands will think about it like that. Some of them will literally buy whatever's off the shelf and make it work for them. And they don't really care about the sound, right? And it's kind of like, how much of an audiophile are you versus how much of a customerphile are you, right? Like, how much do you actually love your customers enough to sort of build these experiences, right? But again, I think it goes back to, what are the things you actually want to do, and it's a really good way of sort of framing what is a very complex, very, as you say, ambiguous technology category. But I do want to shift gears a little bit and talk about generative AI, because I think, the composability stuff sort of blends into generative AI in a lot of ways, because it's a new technology. And I guess the promise of composability type architecture is that you should be able to respond to your customers' needs as they change, as there's new channels, new expectations for consumers, or in this case with generative AI, radically different technology that can really upend how consumers deal with brands. And so maybe we can kick off with this second part of the conversation about, I guess, you're thinking about incorporating generative AI into Progress's developer platform. I mean, you guys are in a lot of different spaces. You provide solutions and interfaces for technologists. How are you thinking about this sort of large language model generative AI shift? And what does that kind of look like right now with your tooling and platform?
Yeah. I guess the way that that I'm thinking about and what I'm kind of preaching, I guess definitely from the Progress side of things, is what we're kind of heading towards, if we're not already there yet, is that AI is ubiquitous. You know, like it's around now. We can use it. You know, whether you're talking about there's all sorts of different models and services that we can kind of sign up with. But so if it's ubiquitous, everyone's kind of got access to it. Then how do you start to stand out if everyone's got access to AI? And from my point of view, that comes down to two things that you're going to add to it. One is a bespoke data set, right? So, you might have, customer records, you might have your own content that's not freely available to the outside world and not training any other kind of models or AI services that are out there. So there's the data component to it. And then secondary is the interfaces. What's the interface that you kind of put up for people to access AI? I think in terms of from an interface perspective, I think we ain't seen nothing yet. Everyone's kind of using this ChatGPT, which is very kind of running at the speed of computers from the early 80s. Like writing text across the speed one character at a time, but we're all kind of blown away with it because of the content that it produces. But from a technology perspective, it's not super impressive, is it? Like, back when the smartphone came out, people were pulling these out of their pockets and everyone's excited about it. Oh, wow, an iPhone or whatever it was. And look at the technology. I haven't found that the same things happen. Like, to me, AI is far more impressive as a technologist. But the general population, if I pull my phone out and say, hey, look what happens if I get this to write this, it's kind of, maybe people aren't believing it or whatnot, but you've just pulled out a pretty massive computer or the access to a pretty massive computer that, just would blow people away. It should blow people away, but it's not really kind of having that effect. So I think we're still kind of in this kind of early adopter kind of life cycle with that. Sorry, have I gone off your question? I feel like
no, this is it is interesting you raise that, because I think one of my hypotheses around tech trends is that the form factor always leads the trends that matter, and the smartphone was a form factor, right? So we're currently sort of speaking remotely here. I've got my laptop in front of me. I'm looking at my laptop, my screen, my keyboard. It's all form factors. That's hardware integrated with my Mac OS software that's allowing me to do this work, right? My iPhone, same deal, right? A different form factor. I don't have a keyboard that I physically type on, but I use it with my thumbs. I can take it anywhere, right? The portability of the internet was what the smartphone kind of brought into the world. And that form factor was the sort of the determining factor, right? If you look at, like, say, an adjacent form factor, which is like VR, and 2 years ago, this episode probably would have been about the metaverse, right? Or how you're incorporating the metaverse into Progress's development stack, because the metaverse was what every single person was talking about. And, Mark Zuckerberg was trying to lead this quote unquote new future into the metaverse with this Oculus VR headset technology, right? It's a hardware technology, but the form factor just didn't take off because it's not asynchronous. It's not, you can't use it while you're bored. You have to use it sort of in all the different, it has to totally encompass your whole attention, and it doesn't really work with the portability factor, which was such a breakthrough for smartphones. So it's a new paradigm, it's a different paradigm. But however, generative AI just uses the same form factors, right? There's OpenAI is not inventing new hardware to use generative AI. There are some technologies like Humane, which have just, Silicon Valley VC backed ex-Apple engineers type startup trying to develop new hardware. And they just did a TED talk actually not too long ago, looking at some of their new hardware and how they use AI within it, right? But perhaps the shift we need for this type of technology is a hardware shift. I don't know. I'm interested in your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, look, I can't speak too much on the hardware, but I think that there's so much, there's so much scope. Like, I'm super excited about what we're going to see. I'm very kind of pro AI. I think it's going to be kind of quite beneficial to mankind, if I want to get as deep as that. Like, I think that when you look at the applications in the healthcare space, the accessibility space, making our lives easier, doing things that we don't want to do, all of that kind of thing. You know, there's so much opportunity. However, I think that what a lot of people are wrestling with, and this could be individuals, companies, countries, you know, is how fast do we go at this? What is it that we do? And I think, you know, progress in with its background in data connectivity and interfaces is poised to kind of, you know, be with people along that journey. But I think we kind of really need to realize that, every use case is going to be different. Can I use generative AI to produce this content? What if I make a mistake? What's going to be the outcome of that? Who's going to discover it if I make a mistake? Is that going to be an editor down the chain? Well, that's not so bad. Is that going to be a customer? Well, it might still not be that bad. Is that in our terms and conditions? Well, now it starts to get bad because now we can get sued or whatnot. I think that there's all of these different kind of implications, and depending on which geo you're in, you know, then there's going to be a whole bunch of other things that might be kind of layered on top of you.
Yeah, and I think that with generative AI in particular, it does have a lot of implications for software. And I think the thing that, you know, outside of the, you know, the poems it can write and the, you know, the essays and the books it can write for you, or the quick answers to questions that you might have, you know, or being able to modify and buy something, you know, through generative AI with all its different, say, OpenAI's ChatGPT's plugging the ecosystem, play around with Bing, chat a little bit, and you can see how the language aspect is quite interesting in that it can give you so many interesting answers, but it's pattern matching. It's no internal logic. It's not determining what's true or false. No awareness of context. And so it does have a little bit of awareness of context in terms of understanding your previous prompts and your previous discussions, which I think is quite an interesting sort of breakthrough there. It's got that sort of a history or that memory to it. But outside of that, it doesn't have any sort of context to the wider world. But
that's right, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that the other side of that is code. Its ability to write code. I mean, I've been using it to write small bits of code for generating, you know, charts that I can embed, HTML on my website, things like that, right? And that's just me as a, you know, an owner of a media company, but I'm seeing people increasingly using it to write code or to troubleshoot code or to give them answers. It's kind of becoming the next Stack Adapt in a lot of ways. And I think it's becoming the next sort of, you know, open source answers platform for developers. But, you know, I think that's quite interesting thinking about it from perhaps Progress's perspective, is this kind of the next developer platform using generative AI to write code, maybe even ship it, deploy it, QA it? But what are your thoughts on that sort of angle of it actually becoming a serious tool set within a developer's platform?
Yeah, well, it's certainly not a step that we've made yet here at Progress. We've still got real live engineers writing all of our software and all of that kind of thing. But I don't think that there's a techie in the world that's not, you know, like, you know, is really kind of grabbed this and, you know, gravitated to it and is looking at, you know, how it can be useful. Look, I like you, I've played around with it from the, you know, that development perspective, or, you know, can it kind of work me through a project? Maybe it's migrating from one system to another or writing a bit of code to do this and that. And I think it is very good, but I think that there's a few times where I think it's got me, you know, quite a fair way to a complex task, but because I didn't have the knowledge like that, no, whether it's the knowledge of JavaScript or, you know, the end system that I was trying to integrate with, it couldn't get me all the way there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and like that 20%, you know, I think you still need, you know, a knowledgeable person, whether it's writing a blog or writing some kind of application, you still need the human there at the tail end. One, just to make sure it's all okay and it's doing what it, you know, it's supposed to do, because at the end of the day, generative AI's job is to make stuff up. Let's not forget that, right? So blogs we can understand, because we can all kind of read English and all that kind of thing, and we can all kind of attest to the fact that it's going to have a great red hot go at writing a blog that we're going to kind of read it and we're going to think, oh, this is just crap, but, or not crap, but it sounds pretty dry. But hey, it's done a C+ job, and you know, us as content creators really kind of need to come in there and and correct things, add things, probably rewrite the whole lot, right? But I think most people will say that they prefer to edit a document from scratch rather than write one from scratch, right? So for me, I think it very much needs to sit in the co-pilot seat of the plane for now. But I think that a time will come where more and more trust will be given to it, but the right QA mechanisms need to be in play at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. You even look at sort of this role of prompt engineers, which is getting a little bit of attention at the moment, of people that are like experts at hacking the prompt that you put into a generative AI tool, whether that be to create an image or write code, and so like that is like almost a form of coding by just using plain English. But when you read it, it's like, for example, like a Midjourney image prompt engineer would write sort of a query. It's almost like a query. It's like, 30, 40 words long with all these specific dimensions and aspects to it, and there's even a marketplace now for this stuff. And so you think about it, you're like, well, that feels to me like just another development job. It's a tool that's obviously powerful and very efficient, but it still needs that human context. It still needs the ability to, it's not going to come up with the ideas for you, and it's not going to articulate in the way that's going to suit the system best. I just don't think an AI will ever get there. That's kind of AGI realm of like context and ability to actually work with you to figure out the best solution or the best output. I don't think that's going to be with us for many, many years. But on the other side of it, I think that, what I'm seeing, and now that we're a few months in, we got that sort of, back in November 2022, we had the ChatGPT launch from OpenAI. Since then, it's reached, I think they have more than 100 million customers now on the platform. Unbelievable amount of growth in a very short period of time. But I feel like we're kind of getting to a bit more of a stable state now where a lot of businesses are starting to use the technology, see what's valuable for and what's not valuable for, what the risks are. So we're getting to a little bit more of a, perhaps a more stable state, bit of a plateau right now. Not a lot of new feature releases. The amount of startups in the space are starting to slow. And you see this with most tech trends, right? You see that sort of rush of enthusiasm, all this energy and hype, and a lot of new startups launching around it. And then it kind of just peters out. And I think that we're kind of getting to that point where people are getting pretty exhausted, because it's so much to learn about this space and so many opportunities to apply to different parts of the market. But I do want to touch on, I guess, the chat interface itself. And knowing that you've worked at Progress from and other tech companies for so long now, and you've been working on building the interfaces that, these professionals will use to define a customer experience, whether that be like a WYSIWYG editor or a drag and drop with a website CMS to put content into a website, or, even coding terminals, right? Like within the developer's platform, like all of these different things are interfaces to create an end experience for a consumer. So the tools, the work that you need to do to actually create a personalized experience, an A/B test, a new blog or a new content production across a website. But what I'm thinking about increasingly now, Jay, is that generative AI has this chat interface, right? You can write a prompt and you can get something back. And that's kind of a new type of interface. In another show I run with Scott Brinker, we did a 3-part series on generative personalization and generative AI. And we talked about how like the chat interface can be kind of seen as like a new marketing channel almost, the way it's with its integration with different tools and platforms. But I kind of want to think about it from the other edge here is that, what are the right interfaces for these type of generative AI tools? And I'm not sure if you have any ideas or thinking about this around like how would you better embed, say, AI systems into your, say, developer workflows or into the interfaces they use to build the customer interfaces in the other end?
Yeah, this is a favorite topic of mine of late. I think going back a few months, we put together a bit of a demo just to kind of show off Gen AI. I guess ride the hype if you like. Show what's possible with our technology now. One of the products in our offering is a conversational UI developer platform, which you can build chatbots on and all that kind of thing. So we definitely kind of wanted to use it. And we used that. We built an integration with our CMS, our CDP, and and a few other bits and pieces. And we showed how a CMS or a back-end user, a marketer type persona could interact with chat to build out a landing page that not only had AI-generated content, it also had articles that were linked by kind of using AI to analyze the content and look at the classification system within the CMS and link the articles up, create personalized versions of headers and body text, set up tracking in the CDP to track conversions and, views of the landing page and, set up all of that measurement, set up the whole page. And it was all done with under a minute. So we were kind of using that to, even though there was an AI component there, I think that one of the real strong things that pushed across was, does chat have place in the enterprise? We know it's got a place in the sort of business to consumer, even B2B kind of markets, but does it have a place, should people be able to use a chat when they're interacting with some of these enterprise systems, CMS, whatever the system is, really, at the end of the day? And I'm quite positive that there is a space for that. I think that when we think about chat, it's the second most intuitive interface that we have to talk to one another, as opposed to just talking, right? We're chatting on our phone, we're chatting on Messenger, all of that kind of thing. So I think everyone's used to typing in some text and waiting to get a response back. So what we were able to kind of showcase pretty quickly was actually using a chat interface to guide someone through what would normally be quite a complex string of tasks. Maybe not complex, but maybe like, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, you've got to click here, you've got to click here, don't forget to do this and don't forget to do that. Then the chat can kind of guide the user through. And if anything's missing, it can alert them and whatnot. So I'm really excited as to where chat's going. Future looking, if you like. I think we've seen chatbots fail in the past because people have tried to go and create these things that are all seeing, all doing, that they can do everything, and that's impossible. Where I think there's a really exciting opportunity for chat technology is actually when you actually sync it up with the personalization capability, and you can actually recognize who someone is, where are they at in a particular journey. And then if you've got the right chatbot with the right skill, that you can front and center to that user and say, oh, can I help you with this? That becomes great, because, maybe they don't have to go through a form, they don't have to sit on hold to a call center, maybe they don't have to navigate a website. And they can potentially do it in a channel for which they're most comfortable, whether it's Microsoft Teams, if we're talking on the back end, or Facebook Messenger, or WhatsApp, or insert chat app here. There's many of them.
Yeah, I think that there's something unique. Like, I think that there's chat, which is text chat back and forth, which is you know that's a learned behavior. It's a new behavior that humans had to actually understand, which with text messaging and with instant messaging. I mean, I remember when I was a teenager learning MSN Messenger back in the day, right? That's chat, right? That's the interface of chat, absolutely. Right? And I remember I got into trouble when I was in high school because, I was using, there was like, back in those days with MSN Messenger, people would like flood you with these chat rooms of like hundreds of people, right? And it was just kind of wild, crazy time back in the early 2000s. It's just, really interesting. But, that chat interface, you would think that voice would be more natural than chat. But what we've actually seen with voice technology is that it hasn't been that sort of natural adoption that people would want to use. Let's go back to sort of 2018, right? Where, you would have consulting firms talking about voice systems and Google Home and Siri and Alexa and all these sort of voice AI platforms. Now, it's going to be the future of customer experience. Customers can just ask for something from their voice chat assistant, and then their voice assistant would buy it for them, do it for them, give them the information they need. But I think where that fell down as a category, and maybe as an opportunity with generative AI now, but I think where it fell down was that it wasn't visual. There was no interface to it. It was a voice. And only a very small population of people actually appreciate that kind of level of abstraction, I guess. you know. But with, I guess, the chat interface, yeah, it kind of feels more natural. I mean, I would use it every day for research purposes. I would write, hey, do this. I was coming up with some ideas for a new product for TNW, and I said, hey, you know, I want to look at ways to promote the this product, right? And how do I going to get it to market? And I said, you know, it gave me some very bland, basic ideas. I'm like, I want you to give me more crazy ideas. Just give me the nuts ideas. Yeah, so it gave us some more ideas. I said, all right, turn the dial up to like 100 and give me the those nuts ideas, you know, that you've ever heard of. And it gave me these like pretty cool ideas, right? I was like, that's all. Some of them are actually quite cool. You know, and so like that is like a conversational chat interface, which feels more natural. But when it comes to software development and like building customer experiences, I guess you would have that same interface chat on systems like Slack or Microsoft Teams, where say a digital person or a marketer might be interfacing with somebody and going, we want this kind of experience, here's the brief, and then the developer would go back and forth with them. So in that way, it kind of feels quite very natural in that you've got this interplay, this back and forth, this refinement as you have a conversation, as you would with, say, a developer building a customer experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think, one thing like I'll call out, and look, not every platform's the same, but the steps that you work through on, you know, like I refer to our chat application, native chat, it's a conversational UI development platform as opposed to a chatbot development platform, because you step through the same logic. Like you build your bot once, but then you can actually publish that out to a voice server. So if you wanted to have this bot interactable with like via Alexa, for example, then that's just publishing that bot to that environment. You could publish that same bot to your Teams environment, to Facebook or wherever, right? So that's a kind of a cool story. But then on the interface side of things, yeah, if you're talking to the bot via Alexa, we can't show you pictures. We can't show you up a carousel, say, flick through these products or do kind of visual things like that. So I think that's something that's kind of quite exciting that's possible in the chatbot world, that you can, there's no reason why we can't create full e-commerce solutions that are rendered via chat. People can be browsing products, but it can be more like they're talking to a shop assistant rather than navigating a website. But there's a lot more kind of visual stuff that you can pass down the line when you're kind of interacting on kind of those message-based platforms. But that being said, again, it's horses for courses. The option is to make it accessible by Alexa. But I kind of agree. I don't think that we're there just yet, although I think there has been a much more rapid uptake in adoption across kind of voice technology, where it just pertains to people setting timers or, you know, where's my latest order from Amazon. I think it's coming, but just not as fast as we expected it to.
Yeah, and I agree that we'll have to wait a little bit longer, I think, to see a lot of this sort of play out, particularly around the customer experience side of things. And I've started thinking about this for the MarTech Weekly. We wrote a piece on the next sort of frontier for personalization, and thinking about how generative AI has got this real dynamic nature to it. You know, it can be extremely malleable in terms of what you get back from using the tool. And I think that, you know, we coined the term, which is volitional personalization, which is basically this idea of, you know, traditionally personalization is speculating. Marketers, digital folks, speculating, saying, if we provide this kind of personalized experience, whether it be an email or type of image or, you know, whatever it is, if we introduce this to our customers, it's going to drive a better experience or more growth, better revenue, whatever it is. But volitional personalization is actually the consumer, the customer, using these tools to define their own experiences. Volitional is a scientific word for choice and agency. And basically, consumers have more agency over the kind of interactions they want to have with a brand. I mean, a great example from OpenAI actually is using generative AI's plugin store, the ChatGPT tool, using their plugin store to search for a carrot cake recipe, pull down that carrot cake recipe adapted for certain allergies or different preferences, and then being able, in the same interface of chat, send those ingredients of that recipe to Instacart. Instacart pulls up a cart, and then you click with one purchase all those products. And you look at back that, you're like, wow, that's personalization, right? That's a consumer personalizing a shopping cart based on a recipe they modified using chat, and then they get that information back, and it has nothing to do with the data capabilities of Instacart or that recipe's website. The only data they're providing is the metadata of the SKUs and the products in their store for Instacart and the recipe content on that website. And it's fascinating to me to think about, well, how does this change like digital experience platforms and customer management systems? You know, what does this do when consumers have more choice and agency over the kind of experiences they want? But this is far flung into the future, Jay, like thinking, you know, maybe 20 years down the track, who knows, might come quicker. But what are your thoughts on that? I mean, is that a disruptive force, do you think, into this sort of tech category of DXPs? Or do you think we'll just find other ways of sort of adapting the generative AI stuff into the consumer experience?
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept that you bring about there. I think the first thing I'll say would be, I guess a consumer kind of interacting with personalization within a brand in that way is, you know, great kind of credit that brand. They've made it. They're in that consumer's inner circle. I think that, but I would, you know, I think for most brands that don't sort of sit within our inner circle, if you like, I think there's kind of very few. It's, you know, your mobile phone company, it's whatever music platform you listen to, it's whoever you shop with. There's a few customers that we kind of keep kind of near and dear to our hearts. But in terms of, you're driving the personalization experience rather than the technology at the other end. That's a really interesting conversation. I would absolutely. You know, that's what the customer said that they want. So I think you've got to kind of roll with that. And I think it's like, that should definitely be kind of, you know, overriding the implicit personalization that might have been set up by the marketer. If someone says that, someone's looked at a lot of red tops, then they like the color red. We're going to recommend products there. But if they've told us that they like black, okay, we'll stick with that sort of thing. So
yeah.
The explicit overrides the implicit, if you like. I think it's a powerful tool. I think that we've seen that for a long time. I think the ability to kind of customize, tailor apps, you know, dashboards, all of that kind of thing. But I think it's great kind of concept. I think probably just my only kind of hesitation would be, you know, to anyone kind of wanting to kind of look at going down that journey, because no doubt there's investment, as there is, you know, with most things these days. Is your customer the type of customer that's going to want to invest their time to enhance their experience with your brand? Not every brand has that luxury that their customers, when they come online, well, everyone's online anyway, but, you know, I don't go and hang out at my electricity company website. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like they are just there. And unless there's a problem, it's really just, you know, serve me as best you can. Like, but I'm not going to go and, you know, like, I'm going to have very, very little interaction with your brand unless there is a hiccup. You know, and that's just to, if I can throw one more topic into the conversation, I think this is where a lot of businesses are not leveraging MarTech to that fullest extent in this kind of customer service space. You know, but when you think about it, this is where you've got all of the knowledge. You've got a CRM, or you've got some kind of system that tells you where the customers are happy or sad. They paid the bill, have they not? What's their product usage look like? You've got all of this data in these systems. When they hit your website, if they're already an existing customer, a lot of the times they're going to be there just to see what's your call center number. I've got a problem. I need to
call in. Yeah, I want to talk to a real human.
That's right. So if you've got a CDP there in the background, and you're able to kind of pick out who they are, what predicament they might find themselves in, if you can, you know, front up a chatbot, or even if it's just a form or something like that, deflect that call, make it easier for them to deal with their brand. Because believe it or not, no one likes to sit on hold for 45 minutes to have a task carried out that they could have done on an app, or they could have done in a form.
Yeah,
if they just had the right kind of channel given to them.
Yeah, I agree with you there that there's I think there's a lot of assumptions in the idea of like volitional personalization in that a lot of consumers won't care enough to do that. I mean, you know, and I think that like more at a philosophical level, I think that the majority of us don't want that kind of agency, you know. We don't like, because it takes work, right? It's still, the consumer still needs to come up with the idea. They still have to interact with a chatbot. They still have to do all of that stuff. So a lot of consumers don't want that. They want to get to a website, point at a product, click it, buy it, and then be done with it, right? Maybe for marketplaces, it could be some opportunities there, because it's like, give me the best, say, you know, the best prices on electricity, as an example, right? And give me a breakdown, what's best for me in my area. Can you aggregate the product reviews and the sort of the customer testimonials on what the best service is? You know, does it bring that into a cleaner, more efficient way to gather that information? But in terms of actually creating your own experiences, I think that there may be some brands that would benefit from it than others. Maybe commodity is not the space, but still, I think there's some interesting ideas there.
Absolutely.
There's a fun pick and think about, because I think the out of this call we've sort of established, I guess, that that the interfaces for customer experiences are, you know, they're old, right? We've been using them for a long time, and breaking them up and making them more composable across digital experience and customer data platforms means that the people working in the brands have more choice. They can integrate, say, ChatGPT more effectively, easily, because they're not dealing with the monolith. They're dealing with all with a variety of tools that they're orchestrating together. So there's not a single point of failure, right? You can experiment with, say, an edge case in ChatGPT in one area within your stack and not have it sort of impact everything else, or make it an issue downstream for all the other developers working on the same platform. And so I think that's kind of where these two things come together a little bit, is that flexibility, freedom, the higher agency around what you're actually building for your customers is kind of, I see, where the future is going. And for a lot of these types of technologies and experience. But let's round it off here. Jay, if we want to learn more about this stuff, about DXPs, about what you're doing with Progress, where can we find you online, and how can we connect with you?
Yeah, sure. So, feel free to reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn, or check out our blogs on progress.com. We'll probably be the first two ports of call, I'd recommend.
Great. Well, Jay, thanks for joining us. Well, we are interviewing people like Jay Sanderson every week at Making Sense of MarTech. People at the forefront of things like digital experience platforms and customer data platforms, and thinking about how to best use that technology to drive great customer experiences. So if you'd like to stay with us, hit that subscribe button in your podcatcher, review us, and join us on themartechweekly.com. Hey, Jay, thanks for joining us.
No worries, Juan.